family. I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, the host of Black and Published Podcast, and the author of the novel, The Seven Daughters of Dupree. This historical fiction novel is about the secrets kept between mothers and daughters over the course of seven generations, and is told backwards in time from 1995 to 1860. The Seven Daughters of Dupree was published January 27, 2026, and is available everywhere books are sold. So if you can, please consider getting a copy of The Seven Daughters of Dupree today.
Part of what Black writers carry is this idea that even when you call yourself kind of writing about your childhood, you are writing about America in a different kind of way.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published on the Mahogany Books Podcast Network, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. I'm back this week with a bonus episode with none other than Tayari Jones, author of the novel, Kin. In the book, Tayari tells the story of Annie and Vernice, two motherless daughters who grew up together in small-town Louisiana until their deepest desires take them on different journeys through life. It's a journey Tayari didn't even see coming as she wrote and completed the novel.
My editor said to me, you don't go 300 pages. That's unfortunate. At 300 pages, you want to be like, no, shaking your fist to the sky. Why? So that's how we ended up there. And so I took about 150 pages out and put 200 new pages in. I said, oh, Lord, I got to go raise the dead and then kill somebody.
Kin is Tayari's fifth novel and her second Oprah's Book Club pick after 2018's An American Marriage. In our conversation, she explains why she's grateful for her slow burn career. Plus, how she surrendered to the story that wanted to be written, even though it was not the novel she planned. And, as someone famous for the epistolary form and a lover of letters, Tayari tells how that love for communicating via pen, paper, and postage developed when she was just 12 years old. That and more is next, when Black and Published continues. Tayari, when did you know that you were a writer?
I've known all my life that I enjoyed writing. I came to writing as a child the way any other child would, like, oh, I like reading books. Maybe I could make a book, you know, like that. But it really wasn't until that I was at Spelman College, a freshman, when I discovered that I could be a writer, like, as my life. I think that when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, if you were a girl and you liked to read and you liked to write, people thought it meant you were a nice girl. I bet you remember in the 90s when I think it was Chris Rock who said, as a parent, your one job is to keep your daughter off the pole. You remember that? So basically, they're saying the only thing that matters about your daughter is that she is sexually appropriate. Everything else about your daughter is details. Mm-hmm. Respectability, that's it. Everything else is details. And so when you're a girl and you like to read and you like to write, people think, oh, great, you're nice.
You go stay off that pole.
Yeah, it's nothing else. Yeah, you know, there's nothing else to think about you. You are covered. And no one ever says, what are you reading? What are you writing? What are you thinking about? Because your thoughts are irrelevant. Mm-hmm. It is your appropriate behavior that is the measure of who you are, how you're parented, et cetera. So when I got to Spelman College in 1987, you know, Spelman had their first Black woman president. It was a whole different way of thinking about Black women and their lives and their minds. And I met a writer and she was my teacher. And she said to me, what are you thinking about? And I said, and she said, nope, don't tell me, write it down. Mm. And in taking me seriously in that way, she became my first audience, and she encouraged me to think about the relationship between my writing and my thoughts. Mm.
So I'm not going to act like I don't know you and I haven't been like following you forever. You gave this talk at AWP last year about something that happened to you at Spelman where there was like a contest or a grant or something, and you were supposed to win, but they didn't want to give it to you because they didn't want to encourage you to go off and be an artist. Can you tell that story and what happened?
Alice Walker had allocated this money, $10,000, which seemed like more money than I could ever imagine. And there was an advertisement on a bulletin board, and it was a color flyer. And in the 80s, a color flyer in early 90s, that cost more, so you paid attention. And it said that it was to be given to, quote, the young lady who was more or less going to be a writer so that she may calmly look around and find her way. Alice Walker had been given a similar grant when she was at Sarah Lawrence. And I wanted it. And it wasn't even so much that I wanted to go find an apartment in New York. I just wanted that blessing to be the one chosen. And so I applied for it. I went through all this. Like, I went to Kinko's when you had to pay like 10 cents a page, made this whole portfolio. And they didn't give it that year. That year I received a message saying, we are not giving the award this year. We're going to hold it back to create an endowment and we'll give it next year. And I later found out that I would have been chosen, but they were fearful that I had a fellowship to go to graduate school to get a PhD. And they were like, Tiari, we'll take this money, go to New York, try to find some apartment, run out of money in 3 or 4 months, not have any graduate school to go to and be a beatnik and squander her education and all the money her parents have put into it.
Not a beatnik.
And so, yeah, so they didn't give it to me, but they didn't tell me that it was just like, no one was worthy this year. And I was like, ooh. And I did go on to try and pursue a PhD because that was my plan B, my backup.
Did you succeed in that plan B and getting that PhD, or did you leave it alone and go do something else?
No, Pearl Clegg, who is my teacher, Pearl said to me, you don't have to do that. She's like, it'll be fine. You can quit. She said, you do not have to carry a mistake to its fruition merely because it has begun.
All right. And so you didn't do it. You've always known you wanted to be a writer. When did Leaving Atlanta start?
I wrote Leaving Atlanta when I was in graduate school. I went to get an MFA at Arizona State University after I had a chance encounter with a Black woman who was director of that program, Jewel Parker Rhodes. She said, come to Arizona and work with me. I'll help you. I'll be your mentor. And I was like, oh, no, ma'am. I can't move to Arizona. It's hot out there. I don't know anybody. And they don't have the King holiday. And she said, oh, no, we have had a voter referendum and we will have a King holiday for you by the time you get there. And so I went there. I was about 25, 26. And I went there to work with her. And it was my MFA project.
Ooh. And so in doing that as an MFA project and that being your first novel into the world, writing about the South, writing about your hometown, what did it mean? What does it mean to you to be from Atlanta and writing about Atlanta constantly?
Well, I think when I wrote my first book, Leaving Atlanta, it's about growing up in Atlanta during the Atlanta child murders. And a lot of people write their first book about what they grew up knowing. It said my growing up intersected with what I came to understand was kind of a major moment in history, in Black history, which is American history. And so I realized that as a Black person, so much of our day-to-day lives is actually symbolic and culturally and historically significant in a different way. So I think that is part of what Black writers carry, is this idea that even when you call yourself kind of writing about your childhood, you are writing about America in a different kind of way.
So then in writing about America through the perspective of Blackness and even through the lens of your childhood perspective, what do you learn about America in the writing and approaching the page to tell a singular and specific story from your experiences?
Well, one thing that I learned, you know, I grew up in Atlanta during the child murders. So everyone I know knew about the child murders. And I grew up in Blackity Black, Black, Black Atlanta. So I really did not know the extent to which that history had been buried. Mm. I did not write this to tell the rest of America what happened to us in Atlanta. I wrote it really with the idea of an audience of those of us who lived through it to think about what it meant to us. But because I was writing about it and working on it in graduate school in Arizona, and you know, most of my colleagues, my classmates were white, I found out people didn't know. And I do think that informed the writing. I feel like when I left Atlanta, I was constantly being reminded that everywhere is not Atlanta. Because I mean, growing up in Atlanta, I did not believe that Black people were a numeric minority. I had heard it, and I think I intellectually believed it. But for me, it's like when they tell you the world is 80% water. Here, look at this globe. And you're like, yeah, that's a lot of blue on that globe. But emotionally, you feel like if the world is 80% water, how am I standing here? How are we sitting here? Where is the 80% water?
Where is the water?
And that's how I felt about, you know, being a racial minority, I guess. But where are they at? Where are these white people? That, as far as I know, they all live on the TV.
You just have to leave Atlanta. Like, then you don't have to go that far.
I went to Iowa and I was like, oh my God, it's true.
Yeah, that's a very white place. Okay. What is it about writing about Black girlhood that intrigues you?
You know, I was a Black girl for many years.
I'm aware of that, but like you, it's a subject you keep returning to, like leaving Atlanta, and then you have, I think about Silver Sparrow, those girls, you have Kin Now, those girls. Like, I don't know if I always see adult fiction fixated on girlhood, and so I'm curious.
Well, leaving Atlanta, it was about my childhood. So that was just that. And with Kin, I mean, Kin is a strange novel in that it came to me. I've never had a novel come to me. I normally go to it. I say to myself, self, I want to write about the child murders. Self, I want to write about outside children. Self, I want to write about incarceration. I was like, self, I want to write about gentrification. And the book was like, well, that's too bad because we kind of want to write about coming of age in the Jim Crow South. And I was like, no, I actually have a contract to write about gentrification. I'm going to write about gentrification. And I have never, ever come to loggerheads between my intention and I guess what we'll call the muse or the universe. This has never happened to me, and I do not want it to happen again. But this, I'm not a terribly controlling person. You know, I don't outline my books. I don't know what's going to happen at the end, blah, blah, blah. So I'm like, okay, I accept that I don't know where the story is going, but I do like to say I know what the story is.
Oh, I am fascinated. I would think you had plotted and outlined and had, you know, all the dots connected to what and where and when and how. You do none of
No,
that.
ma'am. That's boring to me. I feel like I write the story to find out the ending. Like the same feeling you would have if you were reading a novel and someone spoiled it. It's how I would feel if I were writing the novel and spoiled it myself. So I just write to figure out what these people are going to do. And often, I will say, I normally end up rewriting the ending a couple, three times because where I send them, I'm like, I don't think that's where they need to go. And I back up about 50 pages and send them somewhere else and say, I don't know. I back up. And then I'm like, oh, now they're where they're meant to be.
Well, that would drive me crazy. Like, I write with the ending in mind. The middle, it gets a little hairy, but I know where we're supposed to
See,
go.
for me, when I try to write something where I know the ending, I feel like I can see feel myself aiming for it. I feel like my novels are often very surprising to readers because they're surprising to me. The twists and turns often surprise me. I'm like, oh, that, like when I was writing An American Marriage, I feel that American Marriage is 8 years old. I don't think there are any spoilers after 8 years. I was like, oh my God, of course that's his dad. That makes all the sense in the world. No, only person more shocked than Roy was me.
So, since we're here, you use the epistolary form in American Marriage, and it also shows up in Kin. What do you love about letter writing?
I am a letter writer. I write letters all the time. I probably write about five or six letters a week. I just love communicating in that way, and I write them early in the morning when it's too early to call anybody anyway. So if I want to talk, I will write the letter. And I know people like receiving letters. But I actually started writing letters when I was about 12 years old. My parents, for reasons they would have to explain to you, decided we needed to move to Nigeria. And I was the most miserable, unhappy, alienated child to have ever lived because I was like, I want to be home with my friends. You know, you're 12 years old. That's not a time to be disrupted. And I wrote to my little friends every day. And it took a long time for the letters to get return to me because you know it takes a long time for the mail to get there and the mail to get back. So for a couple 3 months, I was writing with no expectation of response. And it did not diminish my pleasure in it. I felt like I was visiting with my friends. And now in my life, I've lived so many different cities that I have so many people that live elsewhere. And I write to them and I enjoy it. I love receiving mail back, but I also never want anyone in my life to feel like they're in letter debt. No one owes me a letter. And people say, I owe you a letter. I'm like, no, you can write me back if you like, but you do not owe me a letter.
I want to go back to the gentrification novel. What was that supposed to be?
It was going to be so good. I live in a fascinating part of Atlanta. I live in Glenwood Park. And it used to be a cement factory, but they built all these houses here in 2008, which means, though, just over here is East Atlanta. And then, you know, we're close to downtown, we're close to the Beltline. So we're right in the center of town where all the elements of Atlanta come together. And in the center of our neighborhood, we're having like a real contentious battle over a park. We have a park in the middle of the subdivision. And it's green space right in the middle of the city. People bring their children from other neighborhoods to play in the park. And these people put a fence around the park. And so I was like, oh, it's a metaphor. It's a metaphor right here. 3 blocks over from my house is a metaphor. And it made me think about the women of Brewster Place. You know how they tear down the wall at the end? I was like, oh, we're going to tear down this. We're going to write this story and maybe we'll tear down the fence. I was hype. I was excited. You know, I feel like the neighborhood is New Atlanta because it's, you know, it's integrated. And Cynthia from the We Are Housewives used to live 3 doors down. I mean, what is there not to like about this for the setting of a novel?
Okay.
Except the novel didn't want to happen. The novel was like, no, I don't think so.
Annie and Bernice said, nah.
I was like, novel, you don't get to say you don't think so. The novel was like, unless we do. And so I was trying to write it, but it was cold. It didn't have the heat that comes when you're like on the right track creatively. It just felt like I was working. This Lithuanian writer once said to me, you feel like you're working with hammer and nail, but when you're doing it right, she says, angel sits here, and she tapped her shoulder. Angel sits here and whispers the words. No angel was sitting here and saying nothing. I was just going at it, hammer and nail, making a racket when I should have been making music.
Okay. Love it. So when did you abandon that for the novel that wanted to be written?
So about 2022-ish, I started writing on paper, like notebook paper and pencil. I didn't even use pen. I mean, I sharpened my pencil with this pencil sharpener. Like I was old school. And I just wrote just for kicks, just scribbling. I call it word doodling. Mm-hmm. And that's when Annie and Bernice came to me and I said, oh, that's interesting. They must be the parents of my characters who are living in Atlanta in a gentrified neighborhood. Because certainly I am not writing about the 1950s and 60s because I do not do that. I am a contemporary novelist. And then when I was about 125 pages in, I said, okay, well, maybe this is not backstory. Maybe this is the story. Keep in mind, my book is about 3 years overdue, and this is not the book they have paid for, but it was the book I had. So we just roll with it.
I love everything about this. 3 years overdue, not the book that you wrote in the proposal. And you had all these handwritten pages?
Mm-hmm. And I keyed them in and I finished. I turned it in. I didn't say nothing. I just turned it in like, here you go. And then I like ran out the room, basically.
What was the response? What was the email back once they got it and read it?
You know what? They didn't even say, this isn't even the right book. But I found out later that my editor had told her assistant, she said to him, could you pull the paperwork? I think something is not exactly the same. But they were into it. I think at the end of the day, they want something they can be into.
No matter what it is. No yes. matter what the contract says.
Yeah, they're like, well, okay.
But this is what we got.
I still want to try to write my gentrification book.
I think you should let that go.
But it's interesting. It's right now. It's about race. It's about changing South. It's about coming home. It's the right book for someone to write. Maybe not me, but I hope I'm going to give it one more shot. I think it could be like, love when you run across somebody you used to know, but y'all didn't vibe back then. And now y'all are vibing. It's possible.
I love those rom-coms. I love those movies.
Yes.
So much.
Yes.
I'm going to send you all the writing juju that you need to get to your gentrification book. Cause I see it really disturbs you that you did not write what you intended to. In thinking about your journey through publishing and getting to where you are now, where, you know, what you write is accepted with great fanfare and also great aplomb, what have you learned about yourself over the course of your career?
I think the thing I've learned is that, one, I'm very grateful for the slow burn quality of my career. When I wrote my first book, someone said to me, you don't want to come out the gate too hot. And I said, actually, yes, I do. I want to come out the gate really hot. And he was like, nah, you don't want to come out the gate too hot. And I felt he was just trying to soften the blow of my first book not being any kind of bestseller or anything. But now I totally understand that a slow burn career, you have the pleasure of the climb. With every book I wrote, something new happened. Like I remember with my first book, I was given a small tour, but I didn't get to go west of the Mississippi. And then later when I was invited to the Los Angeles Times Book Festival, I was like, I'm going to California. And when I got to the festival, they had these mugs. I have one up there. They have these mugs and you had to sign for the mug. And I signed for my mug. And I noticed some of the more famous writers, they didn't even go get their mug. And I was like, who wouldn't want this adorable mug? But they were taking it for granted because they had done these things so often. And I realized that if I had come out the gate hot, I would not have had the pleasure of the mug. There's so many things that were just exciting to me. Every single book, something has happened that hasn't happened before because I'm climbing. And I think that when you come out, most people who come out hot, they are not climbing. They end up going down. It's almost like there's a hill. You either climb it or you roll down it.
Ooh, okay.
But we still, all of us still touch every part of that hill. It's just, are we touching it going up it or touching it going down? And so I'm glad for the climb. And it also, when you have a slow burn career, you don't get confused about your why. So for those years that when I was writing and, you know, had very modest success, I always knew I was writing for my readers. I was writing for the people who've experienced the things about which I write because there were no fireworks to distract me. I knew I couldn't be writing for the money because I didn't have any. So I knew why I did what I did.
Okay. What excites you now to publish Kin?
So I had An American Marriage, which for me was this big book. And, you know, I'm poised to do Kin and I'm doing a big tour. I'm doing all the things. But, you know, An American Marriage, I was so overwhelmed. I don't think I was able to enjoy it in the way that I should have. Because I was like, what is happening? What is going on? Who am I? What does this mean about who I am? And, you know, I always thought of myself as a little engine that could. And I was like, this isn't a little engine that could experience. I had such understanding of who I was based on kind of the hustle, the trying so hard. And I didn't enjoy it. I had like a crisis of meaning. And this one, my word of the year this year is present. I'm going to be present. And I'm going to think of how I present because with the world in crisis right now, my idea of platform is different and what you do with it. But also I'm going to realize that this experience is a gift and it is a present. And so that's what I'm really looking forward to learn to enjoy sharing the story with others, enjoy giving the readings, just enjoy it, enjoy my audiences, enjoy how happy this makes my parents, just enjoy it.
All right. So then can you read something from Kin so that people can get a little sense of what they're about to enjoy? Kin by Tayari Jones tells the story of cradle friends Annie and Vernice. Both motherless, the two grow up together in small town Louisiana until the end of their high school years. As they embark on different paths through their young adulthood, they keep in touch and forge a bond that transcends space, time, and even life itself. Here's Tayari.
I'm going to just read from the first page. My first word was mother. Spoken out loud and with texture. Mother. There was a host of witnesses, including Aunt Irene, who called out for God and considered running down the block to fetch the pastor. But before she could even straighten her skirt, she decided that this wasn't a pot to be stirred by any man's spoon. It was August, canning season, and the women were gathered to put away snap peas and pole beans. It was Louisiana hot, but even more so due to the water boiling to purify the mason jars. Aunt Irene, never at home in the kitchen, busied herself plaiting my hair while everyone else hulled and cut up the harvest. The ward sisters sang out amid thick radio static as Aunt Irene added her colorful soprano to the arrangement. Sitting between her knees, I rested my face on her thigh, still as stone and just as quiet. Sharp against my scalp, a rat-tailed comb created precise parts. After the death of my parents, I had shown myself to be a peculiar child. No one could say if I was born that way or if I turned that way. I walked early and would do so in my sleep, escaping my crib. I once found my way to the front porch where I was discovered humming with my face resting on the matted fur of a stray puppy. At 2 and a half, I had yet to speak. Folks worried that I was slow. My cradle friend, Annie, was already talking up a storm. She even gave me my nickname because Vernice had been too many letters for her to hold in her mouth at the same time. Niecy, she called, determined to shake loose a response. When shouting didn't work, she tried kindness, breaking her shortbread cookie in two. I smiled in gratitude and sometimes offered sloppy baby kisses in return, yet I didn't say a word.
Where did these motherless girls come from?
I don't told you, I don't know.
Ma'am, I need a better answer than I don't know.
I have never had this experience before in my life. I think that I know where the town came from. My daddy grew up in a small town in Louisiana, and I've always felt like my daddy is kind of an immigrant to the city of Atlanta. And anyway, in many ways, both my parents were also immigrants to a different America, in that they grew up under Jim Crow. And then they raised their children in Atlanta in the era of Maynard Jackson. So I know that that kind of journeying within the South was something that is an obsession of mine, this idea of this geographic and generational divide.
Mm-hmm.
But these girls with no mothers, well, and they're also raised by people who didn't really want to raise them, but had to.
Yes.
And, you know, think about this. Think of how many people we knew we grew up with. Well, I don't know about you, but who were raised by their grandmothers, raised by other people. All these people I knew who were raised by other people, it never occurred to me to say, where were their mothers? Because it was common enough where it didn't even get your attention. If someone said, oh, you know, I stay with my big mama. You'd be like, okay, some people do. But I'm now thinking about what does it mean to be reared by someone whose idea it was not.
But I've even realized that with my own book that's out, and that a girl growing up without her father is not a questionable situation. It's just like, oh, okay, it's just you and your mama. And nobody stops, nobody questions, no one asks. It just keeps going. But about these girls, you say on page 9, but this is how life works. The women who will be capable mothers too often don't want kids. And too many of those with children probably should have just sat that one out. Luckily, most were in between, maybe not baby crazy, but willing. And as a mother, I felt a little dragged, just a touch. I was like, I guess I was baby willing.
First off, you said the book you had come out, I think you should say The Seven Daughters of Dupree. I want you to say the name of your book every time.
It's a whole ad at the top of the show. But the book is The Seven Daughters of Dupree. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. But I do think that sometimes women who decide, almost like the wisdom to know that you're not mother material, might mean that you might be mother material in a way. You know, that kind of self-awareness. But also there are people who know they're not, like Aunt Irene. She knew she wasn't mother material, and she wasn't mother material. She's always saying, oh, Lord, I do not know how to talk to children.
And I love that part, because when Vernice gets old enough, she's like, well, I'm not going to talk to you like a child. I'm going to talk to you like a woman. We're going to have a real conversation. We're going to have a drink too. I was like, okay. The tables have turned. What is it about that rite of passage from girlhood to young womanhood that for, I guess, these particular characters allows them to take the reins of their own life and forge their own paths outside of what their grandmothers or their aunts would want for them?
Well, here's the thing. In the 50s and 60s, 17, 18 was grown. Like if you write a novel now and if people are 17, 18, that would be considered the story of girlhood. But in that time, you're grown now. Her aunt is like, let's sit down, let's have a drink. And I'm going to tell you who I am as a woman. And that is the rite of passage. Your elders allowing you to see them as women and not symbolic figures.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, you know, it's kind of like you have to decide what kind of woman you want to be. And I think you have that moment when your elders let you see them, you start to decide, what do I want to be? And I want to say, we all reserve the right to change. Like once you can make a decision, and then a little bit of life can show you, well, maybe you want to be something else.
In that scene where Vernice and Aunt Irene are having the conversation and Vernice is deciding what kind of woman she wants to be, her cradle friend Annie has also made a decision about what kind of woman she wants to be as she absconds from the town where they live on a search for her own mother because she has this hope in her heart. And yet they maintain kinship across the letter writing. When Annie goes forth and into the world with her ragtag band of friends or soon to become friends, they stop in Mississippi between a boarding house and a whorehouse. Where did these twins, Lulabelle and Lorelia, come from? I just want to know the origins.
Well, I have to say that when they got to Lulabelle's and discovered it was a whorehouse, and Lulabelle said, oh, you must have rubbed my sister the wrong way for her to send you here. I said, yes, sister. I said, I could see that. I could see that. Okay. The twins are so different, but they also are bonded despite their, because Lorelia is churchy. She won't let our characters stay at her boarding house because
shacking
they're
up.
Married. Yeah, we don't shack up here. This ain't no hot sheet. What did she say? No hot sheet establishment. But then she sends them down to the whorehouse, and then they're clutching their pearls when they get to the, it's so much clutching of pearls.
It is. But she sends them to the whorehouse and then tells her sister, don't put them to work. I was like, so she care a little bit.
Yeah, she's like, do not exploit these young people, but they can't stay here doing God knows what.
I know the central friendship is between Annie and Vernice, but I really like baby doll Ruth Ann.
Yeah, you can't help but like her. She's something else. For what it's worth, she is the only person from my poor gentrification novel that survived.
When Vernice goes off to Spelman, the church has taken up a collection on Irene, hasn't gotten money from her Ohio man. They got the Samsonite cases, and she encounters a misfortunate event on that their Trailways bus and gets thrown off. I know you say historical fiction is not what you do, even though you have done it. In writing that scene, was that something that you had heard of other people's stories before going to Spelman, or is that just something that you wanted to see on the page?
You know, I read this really interesting memoir by a woman by the name of Debbie Johnson Roundtree. It's called A Mighty Justice. Debbie Johnson Roundtree went to Spelman. A lot of Spelman years were gleaned from what she wrote about. But the thing that came to this is that Debbie Johnson Roundtree, she ended up going to Howard Law School, one of the first women to go. She worked in a law firm, a Black law firm, where all they did was represent people who had refused to give up their seats on public transportation. They were young people, old people, bourgeois Black people, poor Black people, men, women, Northerns. Black people resisted that transportation segregation left and right. It was given to us in history, like Mrs. Parks was the first person to give up her seat. Mm-hmm. But people did it all the time and they got thrown off. And so I wanted to write about that as well, about someone getting thrown off, you know, and that it was a matter of course. Like no one was like, we're so shocked this happened. It was like, here we go, and threw her off the bus. But of course, she thought she was sitting in the front seat of the colored section, but she was accidentally sitting in the back seat of the white section, which I think shows the absurdity of this segregation and this racism. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to just show that people resisted all the time. Even accidentally.
And my mother, she always tells a story because she grew up in New Orleans in the lower Ninth Ward, that when they would catch the bus on their side of town, they would just move the sign. They would
There you go.
Like they would unhook it and move the sign further up so they would have more space.
See, Black people. Yeah, but people were resisting all the time. I think the reason why Mrs. Park's story is told as it was is that for the conception of wider America, it needed to seem almost accidental. Just like the Loving versus Virginia couple, they tell their story like, huh, what? Interracial marriage is illegal? Oh, we didn't know. We were just in love. That the idea of organized Black resistance is kind of terrifying. That's just not the way they want their story told.
You show glimpses of what that organizing looked like on the campus of Spelman with the character
Mary Linda.
Yes,
Mary
Linda. The conductor in that first floor bedroom. I was like, oh. In detailing the experiences there, one, I felt like it was homage to, I know you're a Spelmanite, to Spelman, to Vernice's roommate, Joette, and they go way beyond just being roommates. Ms.
They
May,
fall in love.
They fall in deep love. Like she's calling just to read letters from Annie to Joette. And I was like, oh, this is new. Where did this come? You're just complicating everybody's life.
That's how people do in books, but people act like LGBT rights, reproductive rights, women's rights, they act like all these rights just got invented in the 80s. Mm-hmm. You know, and queer people have existed as long as people have existed. Mm-hmm. And with these girls being cloistered like this, just think they had a 6 p.m. curfew. Everybody locked down in their dorm room from 6 p.m.
The curfew was 6 o'clock?
Yeah, it was 6 o'clock. When I was there, it was midnight on the weekdays and 2 a.m. on the weekends. And for me, that didn't seem like any curfew at all because, you know, Barbara Ann was not letting me out to no midnight on the weeknight. So I did not feel oppressed at all. But yeah, no, they had 6 p.m. curfew in the 50s and 60s. And the penalty for curfew could be expulsion, especially if you were not the daughter of a prominent person. And so, yeah, they started looking at each other. You know who surprised me? It was the midwife and the school teacher.
Really?
I was like, oh, yeah, I guess that was her quote unquote border.
Okay.
And this way that people are willing to let people be queer as long as you don't name it.
Mm-hmm. See, Miss Ola May and Miss Jemison didn't surprise me. I was like, oh, okay, they're together. But okay.
Yes, because by the time you got to them, I had been with them for over a year.
But they surprised you when they first showed up together like they were.
Yes. I was like, oh, Oh, all right, ladies. Carry on.
What fun was it writing about all of these contemporary issues, LGBTQIA rights, reproductive freedom, bodily autonomy, all of those things in a historical setting?
That was where I felt more in control because the principles behind these issues do not change regardless of era. As in so many of the details of the story, era may determine how the story played out, mm-hmm. but the moral underpinnings was solid. And that was actually the place where I could keep, you know, how like when they say when you're riding on a boat and you feel seasick, you just stare at the horizon mm-hmm. to keep yourself steady. I felt like that moral underpinning was the horizon at which I stared.
So then you bring them from the cradle till about like 25-ish. That's the number I gather, but it might be a little younger, a little older. As they become adults and Vernice gets married to this man and marries into this family, she gets picked for this man by the man's mama, and he's 13 years older than her. And I was just like, wait, what is happening and why is it happening? But she goes along with it. And Amy
also
goes,
people used to do that. Like people used to do this again, back to the era. People used to do that. 13 years older was considered a little, she's like, you know, he's a little older than you, but you're going to want someone older because women were married into situations where they were basically replacing their fathers with their husbands. So that setup for her, no one is like, wow, he's so old for you. Everyone's like, yeah, as one does. And really, and she wants that mama. I think that mother is just as attractive to her as the husband.
Mm.
She wants that mama.
So then is that the takeaway? Part of it is that no matter how grown we get, we always long for our mothers because Annie never stopped searching for hers, except for like that one brief period when she thought her real mother, Hattie Lee, had gone to glory. And even though Vernice made peace with her mother's murder, she became a part of this family in part because of the mother that was there.
I think so. I think people want the relationships. Everyone wants to be loved. And we assign that feeling of love to being mothered. But I think that we want to be cared for in that way. I don't know if it has to be a mother, but we think it's going to be a mother. And so a mother it is. The difference between Annie and Vernice is Vernice knows her mother is gone to glory and she's not going to see her again on this side. Then she can allow someone else to take that role. Where Annie, because her mother is living somewhere, she's been saving a seat for her. And nobody can sit in her mama's seat.
But I feel like in the end, Lulabelle sat in that seat.
Kind of, yeah.
I know you say you don't always know where the end is. When you got to the end that we had, were you surprised? How did you feel? What was it? Because I got to the end and I was like, I feel all the things. I don't like it, but it was like, it was historical, but it was contemporary and what happens in the end. And I don't want to spoil it. But I love that as Annie is giving her friend's name and she's like, you know what? Just write this. It's the name I gave her anyway. And showing how they were next of kin.
I just felt a little tingle just remembering what happens at the end. But it actually wasn't the ending I had originally written. I dodged it. I was very attached to these people. And I want the best for them. And so I knew somebody was going to die because
really?
you can't be walking around here saying Joette is from the biggest funeral home company in the Southeast and nobody die.
Okay.
That's like saying somebody is a cook and nobody gets to eat.
I see your point there.
And I felt like, oh, so I knew that was coming. And also I was like, where is Joette? We haven't seen her in a while. So I was like, we probably need to see what's up with her. Mm-hmm. So I said, somebody's going to die. Somebody's going to die. And I was surveying the people in the story like, ooh, which one of y'all is it going to be? And I also knew, Lulabelle says, don't come back. Don't come back. No one who comes back here ever comes back for something good. Mm-hmm. Well, then that is also a promise. You can't have somebody making a big deal. Don't come back. Never come back. They're going to have to come back, clearly. But no, I had somebody else die. Who in this book do you see most likely to die?
I feel like it should have been Clyde. Personally.
Exactly. Yes. But I didn't feel it click into place. And when I ended it the way I ended it, I felt it. I saw one of these social media platforms that Lin-Manuel Miranda's wife said, my husband is writing. He's finishing his play and he's crying and he doesn't want to be comforted. I felt like that because when I finished this, I was like.
And nobody can fix it because it has to be that way.
Right. It had to be that way. But I do like to think that I like to end every book with, I like to give the characters a path forward because I like to think that books are read by people who are experiencing some of the same things as my characters. And I never want someone who's experiencing what I'm writing about to walk away from my book feeling worse than they did when they started. I'm just dealing in the realm of imagination. The whole world belongs to me on this page. So if I cannot figure out a way forward with some hope, what do I want for real people who have to actually deal with the concrete details of their lives? Mick Jagger famously said, "You can't always get what you want, but sometimes you get what you need."
So aside from giving everyone what they need at the end of the book, what do you want your readers to take away from it?
There are so many. This book, one, I hope that this book will be a bridge between generations. I think that, like my mother's generation, they don't tell you nothing. Therefore, you don't really understand who they are, how they are, or the ways that they came to make the choices they made. So I hope this will give. I felt like writing this book gave me some insight into my mom and my aunties, everybody else that's old, that they weren't, it helped me remember they were not always old, for one. And that people had the same questions we ask ourselves, they ask themselves. They may have come up with different answers, and that they can relate to us more than they admit. So that's one. I also want people to think about the emotional cost of Black women working as maids, the way that Black women being domestic servants for white families, when your mothering is hired out, when all the things that we associate with care for your own home and your own family is hired out. What does that mean for what you have left? There's a moment when Mrs. McHenry says, "Someone should really write a book about what domestic work has done to our families." I was like, "Yes, ma'am, someone should write a book about it. That would be me." So I wanted to think about that. And I was born in 1970. Roe v. Wade was 73. Birth control pill came in wide usage at the end of the 60s, which means I barely made it here. But I think that those of us who grew up, came of age with contraception, do not really understand the way that contraception changed the culture and how losing contraception would make it where we would not even recognize our lives. We would not recognize our daughters' lives. Because in the 50s and the 60s, people constantly worried about getting pregnant. It's a subtext of every conversation. So many decisions were made around reproduction. Furthermore, when people could not control their fertility, babies happen. People end up with babies they weren't planning to end up with that aren't even your babies. So the absence of Planned Parenthood is not only affects the baby that wasn't planned, the parents that weren't planning, but other people too. It would change our entire culture if we did not have access to safe, effective contraception.
Before I let you go for this morning, I'm gonna do this quick speed round of the game and let you get off.
Okay, I'm ready.
What is your favorite book?
Song of Solomon by Toni Morrison is the greatest book ever written.
Okay, who is your favorite author?
Toni Morrison, because she wrote Song of Solomon, which is the greatest book ever written.
Who is your favorite poet?
Jericho Brown and Lucille Clifton.
Ooh, I love those. Who is your favorite artist? Any medium?
Part of my heart that says Faith Ringgold, but there's a personal part of my heart that says the late, great Radcliffe Bailey, graduate of Benjamin Elijah Mace High School, class of 1987.
Okay, we'll let those stand. What do you think is the best book to movie or book to series adaptation?
I'm gonna have to go old school. I'm gonna have to go The Color Purple.
The first one.
The first one. Absolutely.
If
Sorry. Yes.
money were no object, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you live? And I feel like I know the answer to these questions, but I'm gonna let you answer them anyway.
Well, I can't. I'm gonna have to live in Atlanta.
I
I'm
figured
a
as much.
person who, American Marriage to First Line says the two kinds of people, those who leave home and those who don't. And then at the end, there's also the next kind of those who come back. I can't see myself leaving Atlanta. This is my place. I feel most at home here. However, if money was no object, I can't even imagine money being no object. But I would like, this is so boring. My answer is too boring. I can't even tell you because I don't want to undermine my reputation as an interesting person.
I think I like that. I like that refusal even more. All right, name three things on your bucket list.
People actually have bucket lists. Well, I want to go to Asia. I've never been. Also on my bucket list is to take an entire year off and not do any work. I don't have to travel. I don't need to do nothing. I want to spend a year just doing whatever I want to do, whatever with no plans. I know that's not glamorous, but with my life, that sounds so heavenly. I would love a year where I don't have to do anything but what my heart calls me to do. I wonder if I will make, I wonder if I could come up with a bucket list in that year of just chilling. That's what I want.
I love that.
What brings you joy?
You know, I have started painting. I love it. I just love it.
And what brings you peace?
I am a very serious journal writer. I write in my journal for about an hour and a half every morning, and it gives me a sort of inner quiet to start the day. And I do my gratitude. I have all these journals. I have like four journals. I have my gratitude journal. I got my what happened was journal. I do all of these things, and it really, I have my prayer journal. I have a guided journal. I do all these things. At this time, communing with my mind gets me, I start every day from a place of peace. Then, you know, the madness starts and it can get crunk right back up. But early in the day, I have the peace that comes from my journal.
So I have to ask, what is your favorite sound?
Rain.
All right.
Favorite instrument sound, piano.
Our game is called Rewriting the Classics. Classic is however you define it.
Okay.
Name one book you wish you would have written.
I can't just be around here being like Song of Solomon, Song of Solomon, Song
yes,
of Solomon.
Yes, you can.
Okay. It is really the greatest book ever written. I had to write an intro to a new version. And when I finished it, the hair on my arm stood up and danced, even though I knew how it was going to end. It still got me. It still got me.
All right. So then name one book where you want to change the ending, and how would you do it?
I had to recently write an introduction to If Beale Street Could Talk. And I was like, I'm not happy with this ending. I'm not happy with this ending because I just felt like Trish did not have a life outside her man.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have liked her to be doing something else with her life other than being this disappointed, heartbroken young lady. I was fine with her being sad because what went down was kind of ugly, but I wanted her to be doing other things.
All right. And my messy question, name Ooh. A book. You can do dead people. Name a book that you think is overrated or overtaught, Professor, and why?
You know a book I think is overrated? Native Son.
Wow, that's a take. Say more.
I think it's overrated or poorly taught because when I was a student at Spelman College, we read Native Son. Our teacher came in there and she said, did Bigger kill on purpose? And we all started fighting about whether or not he had purposely smothered that white woman or not. And she said, you forgot about Bessie. Because in the novel, Bessie's death is like, well, whatever. People don't even remember it happened. We didn't really remember it happened. So I feel like it's a completely a story that totally marginalizes Black women's suffering. The hero beats his girlfriend, rapes her, beats her in the head with a brick, stuffs her down the air shaft while she's still alive, and is written in such a way that you don't even notice that it happened. So I think that if that book is taught, because like I said, my teacher was a good teacher and she taught it well, but I think if not properly taught, I think that it completely contributes to normalizing misogynoir.
I couldn't agree more.
Well, here's something else about Native Son, I think. You know, when The Color Purple came out, you know, people were so outraged by it. They picketed Alice Walker's events with signs. And I remember my same teacher at Spelman said, no one in The Color Purple does anything more egregious than what happens in Native Son. The difference is that in Alice Walker's telling, it is wrong what happens to Black women.
Mm-hmm.
In Wright's telling, it is not wrong. So it is not the violence that people are responding to as a negative portrayal. It is the portrayal of the consequences of violence that is unsettling to people.
All right. My final question for you today. When you are dead and gone and among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about the legacy of words and work that you left behind?
I will say this, especially when I was only writing contemporary fiction, which I am going to get back to. Part of my mission in that was that I was trying to write the moment. I felt like as a Black writer, there was a lot of pressure to write the gaps in history. Like you're writing your grandmother's story because she didn't get an opportunity to. You know, Morrison is writing Beloved because Margaret Garner didn't get an opportunity to. And I was saying that I was going to write my story so that the young people who come after me do not have to worry about my gap.
Mm-hmm.
Just to free up some space for them to do what they want to do. I got this gap covered, ladies. Y'all do something else. So I think that is one of the things I would like them to say. I would like them to say, thank you for handling the 80s and 90s. That's what I would like.
Big thank you to Tiari Jones for being here today on Black and Published. You can follow Tiari on the socials at Tiari on Instagram and Threads. And make sure you check out Ken, out now from Knopf.
You can get a copy of the novel from Mahogany Books and get 10% off your first purchase using code BLACKPUB at checkout. That's BLKPUB. I hope you enjoyed this week's bonus episode. If so, and you want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Tiari about why being a soft-foot woman is not always all it's cracked up to be. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week. Peace.
What's going on, family? This is Derek Young.
And Ramonda Young.
Owners of both Mahogany Books and the Mahogany Books Podcast Network.
We really want to thank each and every one of you for listening to this episode. And if you enjoyed what you just heard, drop us a review and rate us on whatever platform you download podcasts on.
We truly appreciate each and every one of you for supporting us and making us your go-to for Black books. And we look forward to connecting with you all sometime in the future.
Thank you again, fam. And always remember, Black books matter.